You are listening to a summary of Brainwise, a book by Patricia Smith Churchland.
This masterly book summarizes a prodigious amount of research about the workings of the brain. Author Patricia Smith Churchland introduces the basics of neuroscience to the realm of philosophy. She says that present scientific knowledge about the brain makes it implausible that there is any such thing as an immaterial mind or soul. A committed materialist, although she does not make the case for materialism, she puts a mass of incomplete scientific evidence before you and says that more scientific evidence will emerge over the next decade or so to complete the picture and solidify the case. She does not do justice to contrary views, which she introduces as straw men, easily knocked down. That said, Get Abstract finds that Churchland provides a valuable, highly readable discussion of the challenges neuroscience presents to philosophy. She makes it clear that any philosophy of consciousness must be informed by knowledge of the brain.
The mind and brain. Scientifically, the brain seems perfectly capable of doing everything people used to think that the mind accomplished. Current neuroscience says that everything about you, even your most complex, characteristic and idiosyncratic personality traits, is a function of neurochemical reactions. Very probably, people do not have immaterial souls or minds, or wills that choose freely. Consciousness is not mysterious, it is an orderly pattern of perfectly natural and understandable neural activities. What does this imply for philosophy? Philosophers traditionally grapple with big questions, those out of reach of other disciplines. But science has progressed so far that fewer questions are unreachable. Neurophilosophy focuses on the intersection of new neuroscience and old philosophy. Almost from the beginning, philosophy divided into two categories. Natural philosophy considered the natural world, while moral philosophy questioned how people should live. Science long ago replaced natural philosophy, indeed, the very phrase has an anachronistic ring. Now science is making discoveries that are relevant to moral philosophy. Plato and Christian philosophers such as St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine saw the soul as an immaterial entity distinct from the body and originating in the divine. Natural philosophy could hardly address the supernatural. Yet neuroscience now makes it highly dubious that any immaterial soul exists. The crux of the issue dates back to René Descartes, who struggled to explain how an immaterial mind might influence a material body. He attempted to solve this difficulty by postulating that the pineal gland handled interactions between the mind and the brain/body. Today, science proves him wrong, and neuroscience suggests that those who postulate an immaterial mind or soul as the seat of consciousness are also wrong. Why has this idea taken so long to emerge? First, neuroscience depends on technologies that only became available in the 20th century, such as Golgi stains and electron microscopes. Moreover, neuroscience is an infant among scientific disciplines. Science knows a great deal about how individual neurons act, but very little about how neural networks work, and the brain is a vast neural network. To some extent, artificial neural networks, which depend on computers, have made it possible to begin to understand how physical networks may perform such elementary tasks as face recognition. Cognition, consciousness, memory and even reasoning are becoming candidates for the process of reduction, although the scientific work is only embryonic. In the scientific sense, reduction means an explanation of one phenomenon in terms of another. For example, reduction of the temperature of a gas means explaining it in terms of the movement of molecules. Science has not yet reduced cognition, consciousness, memory and reason to neural interactions, but it is getting closer. So far, scientists have identified correlations among neuron activity and various cognitive and mental phenomena, though many unanswered questions remain about those correlations. Consider three hypotheses. 1. Mental activity is no more and no less than activity of the brain, and thus is open to investigation by scientific methods like any other physical process. This is a primary contemporary contention. Proof or disproof of this idea depends on further progress in the science of the brain. That is, some immaterial and non-physical mind or soul possibly does exist. But given what science now knows, it seems unlikely. 2. Cognitive science and psychology describe behaviors, mental abilities and phenomena, such as learning, memory and the sense of self, that require more study. Neuroscience depends on cognitive science to know what needs further explanation, and to explain it. 3. Understanding the mind depends on understanding the brain. This hypothesis is controversial, and those philosophers and psychologists who see the mind as software disagree. They say that understanding the brain's hardware cannot explain its software any more than understanding a computer's circuits explains how Photoshop works. Metaphysics. Metaphysics began as a catch-all science. Aristotle, who invented the discipline, never used that word for it. An editor assigned the label to one of the philosopher's untitled works. It means nothing more than the book after the physics. In physics, Aristotle asked about the observable natural world, why rocks fall but smoke rises, why balls roll so far and then stop, why fire heats. In metaphysics, he attempted to explain the unobservable, what really exists fundamentally, whether Plato was right about the independent existence of mathematical truth, and the like. To some extent, metaphysics is a mix of questions or issues of importance in all the sciences that Aristotle referred to as the first philosophy. Interestingly, he seems to have thought that science would become capable of answering the questions of metaphysics, and he viewed these issues in much the same light as other scientific questions. Later thinkers, however, decided that metaphysics was, in fact, a distinct study with a uniquely challenging set of questions and discrete methods for getting answers. In retrospect, Aristotle seems right. Over time, the field of metaphysics has grown smaller as the number of items susceptible to scientific investigation has increased. Physics, geology, and biology have answered some of the questions Aristotle saw as metaphysical. Moreover, some pragmatists deny that a fundamental, foundational science can be based on metaphysics at all. Evolutionary biology explains all the functions and characteristics of organisms in its own terms, the mandate of improved survival capability. It is able to challenge metaphysical ideas about why, for example, vision exists. Biology believes that the visual system did not evolve for the sake of seeing well, but for the sake of surviving. Sometimes a mutation results in a trade-off between traits. Say, between processing speed and accuracy. But widely adopted trade-offs contribute to human survival. Biology also challenges some widely held ideas about the nature of personality and the existence of the mind or soul. Survival advantages account for the evolution of the neural network known as the brain. Such advantages, plus descent with modification, explain why your ear is similar to yet different from a dog's, or why whales have flippers and people have arms. Similar explanations exist for the workings of the brain. For instance, the brain determines if a person can think rationally or can have intense religious experiences. The brain is largely responsible for the ability to feel emotion. Brain damage or deterioration impairs cognitive function. Lesions in certain regions of the brain can, for instance, eliminate memory. As brain science investigates such phenomena, it is proceeding toward explaining some of metaphysics' most challenging questions. Causality. Causes are present in the universe and manifest in three ways: 1. Precipitating. That is, a cigarette tossed into dry leaves causes a forest fire. 2. Predisposing. For instance, smoking predisposes one for emphysema. And 3. Sustaining. For example, geothermal vents always affect Iceland's climate, making it less icy. People take causality for granted and often mistake correlation for causality. For many years, physicians thought that stress and bad diet caused ulcers. Only in the 1980s did they discover that bacteria causes ulcers. The stress that accompanies the pain of an ulcer is a correlation, not a cause. 18th century philosopher David Hume questioned the very idea of causality. To explain a relationship between two events in terms of causality was to replace one mystery with another. All people can know is that one thing happens and then another thing follows. Hume suggested that the concept of causality was a fiction to account for relationships that were not based on cause and effect. Causality matters to brain science. Science has identified numerous correlations, such as neurons that fire in certain areas of the brain in response to certain stimuli, but is still learning if this is causality or just correlation. However, science already teaches that the brain is a causal machine where nothing happens without a cause. The idea of the self. Descartes suggested that humans have a conscious, immaterial mind and self. Yet, as Hume said, such a self cannot be observed. Science has nothing continuous to point to and say, there, that is the self. Yet people believe in their own existence. When you reflect, you have a sense of yourself. When you think, you are aware of your flow of varying perceptions. You know that if you kick a rock, your foot will hurt. When you wake up, you know who you are. What can neuroscience explain about the notion of the self? Why would human brains invent such an idea? Survival requires an organism to coordinate its own needs, perceptions and memories. It must link the need for food with the memory of where food is and the perception that meat is food, but the arm that reaches for it is not. This is a fairly fundamental idea of what is the self and what is not. An organism that does not recognize its need for food, or that interprets its hunger as belonging to something else, or that eats itself, would perish. So the notion of the self clearly has survival advantages. Just as clearly, brain activity correlates with the ability to form and sustain ideas of the self. Take memory, an important part of the notion of self. Individuals see themselves as separate persons, but also as members of families, communities, and society. Yet people who suffer damage to some areas of the brain lose some memories that are fundamental to self-concept. Similarly, certain schizophrenics lose the boundary between what is self and what is not. Auditory hallucination may make them perceive their own thoughts as hostile voices belonging to others. Alzheimer's sufferers lose their ability to conceive of the self as they lose all other mental capacities. When a gaunt girl suffering anorexia, which may involve nervous system impairment, looks in her mirror, she sees someone fat and keeps trying to lose weight. The brain produces the notion of self. This does not mean that the self is not real, but it means that the self is not a distinct and immaterial entity. Mankind's concept of self may not be perfectly clear, precise, or accurate, but evolution does not have to create the best, most accurate possible version of anything. Evolution merely needs to create a practical, useful version that is good enough to survive. Epistemology. Epistemologists address two questions: 1. What is knowledge? And 2. Where do we get it? Research into brain function is likely to answer these questions. The main divisions in epistemology are between the a priori and the empirical traditions. Brain science says ideas are not non-physical creations of a non-physical mind. Idealism simply does not explain enough to be a serious contender. However, the idealist approach is correct that the mind/brain is not a blank screen on which reality projects itself. Reality is a complex, somewhat idiosyncratic construct. This does not mean that external reality does not exist, but that the mind must achieve representations that reflect reality accurately. Of course, if the non-physical mind does not exist, that calls other great non-physical ideas into serious doubt, particularly ideas of God and religion. Traditional arguments for God's existence are grounded in some scientifically untenable notions. For example, some believe in God because the world is so complex that an intelligent designer must have set it in motion. However, natural selection makes it clear that an intelligent designer was not required to create reality. Random mutations in natural selection sufficiently explain the brain and mind. Others say that God must be the first cause that put all other cycles of cause into motion. But, Hume pointed out that a supernatural first cause is scarcely more plausible than an endless chain of natural causes. Several religions claim that God must exist because he has revealed himself to a select few. But the experiences reported by those who claim contact with the divine can often be duplicated or approximated with hallucinogenic drugs, epileptic seizures, anoxia, or even electromagnetic stimulation of the brain.